Today is Friday, December 11th, 2020. This is part 12 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm just so relieved that we got some precipitation yesterday.
Yeah, how much did we get? Like,
I don't know, because my little rain gauge here at the house doesn't melt precip, but since most of it came as rain, we got 12 hundredths.
I was going to say it's a 16th of an inch, maybe a little more. Yeah, oh my gosh, it's so dry. Well, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. In part 11, we were in 1991. You'd gotten a job at Grand Canyon National Park. A difficult move for you and your wife, who was heavily pregnant, and then gave birth to your son Luke. And you were talking about integrated pest management, IPM, as it's called. And after we got off the phone, I guess you and I got to talking about plague, and you said, "Well, ask me about plague next time." So I'm going to start off by, what do you remember about plague?
Well, it was kind of an interesting sort of thing. You know, I dealt with plague at Petrified Forest because we were worried about the prairie dog towns, and it would periodically sweep through and wipe everything out. And it never, you know, it was never a huge issue at Grand Canyon. We did have issues with relapsing fever from fleas over on the North Rim, and I did get a little bit involved with that, trapping the fleas so somebody else who knew what they were doing could test them out. And we had issues with the Hanta virus when it suddenly became an issue. But plague was, you know, we knew it was out there, but we never had any real issues with it until, oh gosh, it was after I had finished working with integrated pest management for the park. But one of our wildlife people was doing studies of mountain lions, and Eric had found a mountain lion that had a female who had died, and she was kind of beat up, and so he figured that she'd gotten in a fight maybe with a bigger male and been killed. And he was doing the necropsy. Basically, a necropsy is an autopsy that you do on an animal. Doing the necropsy on the lion, and lo and behold, as it turned out, she had not died of a fight. She had died of bubonic plague, and he had exposed himself in doing this necropsy to bubonic plague and died of it. And it was quite the tragedy for those of us in the division and really for the park.
Indeed.
And
what was Eric's last name?
Oh gosh, I'm drawing a blank. Eric, I'll have to look that up.
Okay. And what do you remember about him?
I didn't work with him all that much.
Okay.
His office was not far from mine.
Okay.
But he was always out in the field. He loved doing field work on cats. And he had, you know, we'd done some lion work in the past. Elaine Leslie was his boss, and she was also a wildlife biologist. And so she had started doing some work on mountain lions and discovered that, yeah, Grand Canyon does have apparently a healthy population of mountain lions.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had hired Eric. I believe he was a seasonal. He might have been subject to furlough. He wasn't a permanent employee.
Okay.
But she had hired him to continue the work. And he just he did a bang-up job. He was just always out in the field. He'd studied big cats. He'd worked on, I believe, oh, gosh, I can't remember what country, but he'd worked on snow leopards and that sort of thing. So he was not new to the game. And he'd set up scent traps. What they would do is they'd take a piece of carpet and drive a bunch of carpet tacks through it backwards so that the pointy part of the tack was sticking out in the nap of the carpet. And then they'd soak it in catnip, and then they'd go nail it to a tree someplace.
Hmm.
And then the cats, whether it was bobcats or mountain lions, they would come up and rub themselves against this catnip smoke-soaked piece of carpet. And some of their hair would come out, and then they would do DNA analysis on the hair and be able to tell, you know, whose it was from the DNA. And so that was a way of getting not only a population estimate, but also an idea of what the range of the lions were in the park.
Nice.
And then they'd also fitted out some with radio collars so they could track them and that kind of stuff. So they were getting some really good data on mountain lions. And it was just a real, real tragic thing when Eric died of the plague.
I remember his last name. It's York.
That's right. That's right. Eric York. And he had, he'd been actually misdiagnosed at the clinic. They, mm-hmm. they thought he had the flu and told him to, you know, the usual stuff, go home and rest. And if you're not better in a few days, come back and see us. Well, he went home and rested and died.
Right.
And so that was, like I say, it was a real tragedy.
Indeed.
And it was all just a couple of weeks later that I came down with something. And I was getting this horrible pain in my chest. And I initially thought it was a heart attack. And so I went up to the clinic, and so at Grand Canyon there, and they listened to me and that kind of stuff. And when they didn't run out for a crash cart right away, I figured, okay, it's probably not a heart attack.
Right.
But they weren't sure what it was. And so they sent me down to a cardiologist in Flagstaff. And long story short, a couple cardiologists later, they discovered that I had a fluid buildup around my heart. And later on discovered that it wasn't just around my heart, but it was also around my lungs. And the fluid was what was causing the pain. But they didn't know why the fluid was building up. In fact, they never did find out. And they said, well, you know, they started, you know, it's not the sort of thing that they usually see. And so they were thinking of diseases that they usually don't think of. And when they found out that I lived at Grand Canyon, they said, well, did you know Eric York? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. Did you work with him? And I said, yeah, his office was just down the hall from mine, next door to mine down the hall. But I didn't work with him all that much. And they immediately started thinking plague.
Okay.
Because Eric had just died within the month previous. And so I must say, in the Flagstaff Medical Center, I got excellent care. And they eventually determined that it wasn't plague, and they drained enough of the fluid that my body was able to handle the rest of it. I never had a recurrence of that. But I spent a sleepless night in the ICU while they kept monitoring me and coming in and doing all kinds of tests and checks.
Yep, waking you up, making sure that you weren't getting comfortable.
Yeah, making sure that I wasn't going to die of plague on their watch.
Right.
So
interesting.
So those, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, most people just think of the bubonic plague as something from the Dark Ages, but It still crops up here in northern Arizona.
You know, I'm surprised that your team at the Science Center didn't get a little round of antibiotics, which they were giving out like candy, certainly at the clinic and at the school where he went and gave a talk about mountain lions the day before. He was going to do that, but he didn't. There were a bunch of people that actually got treated for that. I'm surprised that you guys didn't. Huh.
Yep. And for whatever reason, I didn't.
Okay.
We had lots of safety training. Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, in all my years at Grand Canyon, I saw one mountain lion from about 20 feet away, and it was running away from me.
Tell me about that story. Where'd you see it?
It's almost an air quality story. I was out servicing some of my equipment, and one of the instruments was on a timer. And it was a timer, not a clock. So it had to, every hour, it would take a reading. But for various reasons, sometimes the timer would forget and reset itself to the wrong time.
Oh.
And so at precisely 3 minutes past the top of the hour, and we'd set our watches to an atomic clock to do this, at 3 minutes past the top of the hour, we'd press a button on the machine, and that would reset the timing, and that would generally fix the problem. Well, I went out to Grandview Point, and the timing was off on the machine, and I had 45 minutes before I could press the button.
Oh, okay.
Which really wasn't enough time to go back into the village,
right?
Because then I'd just have to turn around and come back out again. So I cleaned up the station and still had plenty of time, so I thought, well, I'll just go for a walk along the rim. So I'm following this little game trail, and I was probably not more than 50 yards from the instrument when this lion just jumps up out of the bushes in front of me and runs off into the woods.
Wow.
And it was obviously more scared of me than I was of it, but I looked at my watch, and I still had like 20 minutes before I could press the button. And so for that whole 20 minutes, I'm out there in the woods thinking, wow, that is so cool to see a mountain lion like that. Is that grass waving over there? Is that a twig cracking in the woods? You know, am I still on top of the food chain?
Yeah. So. You look at the mountain lion running away and go, I'm glad you think you're not on the top of the food chain, because I know differently.
I hope this wasn't a ruse and you're circling around.
Yeah, you and your friends set me up. Well, you run away and he'll go back this way and then we'll get him.
Yeah, So that was my one mountain lion experience at Grand Canyon.
Wow, beautiful.
Although lots of visitors saw mountain lions. But then we'd say, okay, where did you see it? And they'd tell us. And say, okay, how long was its tail? And invariably, well, this lion got caught in a trap because it had a really, really short tail. Anyway, so yeah, getting back to my job.
Yeah.
I talked a little bit about last time. Well, actually, a lot about the integrated pest management work that I was doing, and the water quality work that I was doing, and how those gradually disappeared as air quality kind of consumed my career.
Do you know who started the air quality program before you at the Canyon?
It had been going on intermittently since the late 1950s, actually.
Oh, wow.
And it was kind of a combination of things. One is that Grand Canyon is remote in reference to most pollution sources. We're a long way from any big cities and all that kind of stuff. So it was a great place to get background information. You know, what is air quality like in areas that aren't subject to an urban pollution, a big industrial facility or whatever? And so work had been going on there for quite a while. And then there was one guy, especially, his name was Bill Malm, M-A-L-M, and he worked for the Air Resources Division. And I talked to during my Petrified Forest about Class 1 areas
right.
The Clean Air Act designated as areas that should experience only very minor increases in pollution levels and should be restored to natural visibility conditions. And so Petrified Forest was one of those, but so was Grand Canyon. And need I say, Grand Canyon was a lot more important to a lot of people than Petrified Forest was.
Hmm.
And so various researchers had worked at Grand Canyon, and as the Park Service started getting a handle on air quality management in the national parks, the Air Resources Division, a division out of the Washington office, had set up monitoring protocols so that the different parks would collect their air quality data the same ways. And at Grand Canyon, we had a lot of the same kind of stuff that I had experienced with at Petrified Forest, but we had more, and there was, and then we also had some cross-study sites. So at Petrified Forest, we had measured visibility with a camera, just, you know, taking a picture every day at the same time of the same view to try and see, get a visual record of how clear the air looked. And then we had the instrument, the transmissometer that I talked about that shoots the measured beam of light.
Right.
You know, at Petrified Forest, we had one. At Grand Canyon, we had two. One of the light beams traveled along the rim of the canyon between Moran Point and Grandview Point. And then that's the one I was servicing when I saw the mountain lion. And then the other one shot a beam of light from Phantom Ranch up to the south rim at Yavapai Point.
Hmm.
So we had that one going. And then we had two of the particle samplers, the filters that actually collect the particles in the air that create most of the haze.
Okay.
One of them was on the south rim up originally at Hopi Fire Tower, and the other one was down at Indian Garden. And then we were also measuring acid deposition is what we call it. Most people call it acid rain, but a lot of the acid deposited from the atmosphere, especially in a dry place like Grand Canyon, comes down as dry deposition, little particles rather than dissolved in the rain and the snow. And so we were measuring both of those. We had a, and that was new for me. The wet deposition, the rain and snow, was up at Hopi Fire Tower, and it was just a couple of big plastic buckets. And then there was a rain sensor and a motor that would move a lid. And so when it wasn't precipitating, one bucket would be open. And then as soon as it started precipitating, the motor would move the lid over to the other bucket, and we would collect the precipitation.
Hmm.
And then once a week, we would go out and change the precipitation bucket and do some preliminary analysis there at the park on just how acidic the water was, and then send the sample off to, at that time, I'm not sure if it still is, but at that time, the University of Illinois did a more complete analysis of the precipitation.
Okay.
Then for the dry precipitation, we had special filters where we would just, kind of like the particulate filters, where we would just suck the air through the filter every week, change the filter out, send it in for analysis. And that sampler was at a place we called the Abyss sampling site. It was about airline distance, about a mile east of Hermit's Rest on an old service road in an old old quarry that had been used just for building the Hermit Road.
Mm-hmm.
And also in that quarry, we did our ozone sampling. And then later on, the wet deposition monitor, the two buckets with the motor, was moved there as well.
Okay.
Also at the Abyss, EPA had their own ozone sampling system. And so two national parks, Grand Canyon and Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, had both the Park Service and the EPA ozone samplers set up so that we could compare the results from the two monitoring systems.
Oh, interesting.
See if there were any systematic differences between the two.
What did you find with that?
That there at Grand Canyon, there wasn't much difference, even though there were, there were some differences in how we collected the, how we sampled the air, the elevation of the inlet sample, and some of the mechanics and the actual brands of instruments that we were using.
Okay.
At Grand Canyon, they didn't appear to make much difference. At Shenandoah, they did.
Huh.
And so consequently, after several years, the Park Service switched, they didn't switch the instruments, but they did switch the sampling protocol, how high above the ground the inlet for the air intake was, and that sort of thing. They did switch to match more closely the EPA's so that those differences at Shenandoah could disappear. And basically what they decided the differences were probably the result of the vegetation at Shenandoah. At Grand Canyon, our sampling site was out in the pinyon juniper woodland, so our forest giants out there were about 15 feet high, whereas Shenandoah is in that eastern deciduous forest. And even though the sampling site was in a clearing,
right,
the forest type around there was enough that there was sampling at 3 meters versus 10 meters made a difference in how much ozone you would collect out of the air.
So a meter is about 3 feet, so it's 9 feet versus 30 feet
right
in the air. Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And like I said, at Grand Canyon, that didn't make too much difference, but at Shenandoah, it did. So we were doing that sampling when I arrived, and then later on, we did add some more instruments. We started monitoring ultraviolet radiation.
Okay.
Right about the time that the ozone hole over Antarctica became a big deal, the ozone hole over Antarctica got all the news. But actually, they were seeing a thinning of the ozone pretty much all over the world to some degree. And that has the ultraviolet radiation has a big impact on certain plant species, including a lot of crops. And so the Department of Agriculture was setting up a nationwide system of rural ultraviolet radiation monitors.
Uh-huh.
And Grand Canyon, I applied, and Grand Canyon was chosen to be the site for Arizona for ultraviolet radiation monitoring.
Ooh.
So we added that, and then we added a new way of measuring visibility with a light beam. The transmissometer that I talked about earlier, you had a transmitter that would send out the light and a
right.
receiver that would measure the light.
Right.
You knew how bright the light was. You measured how bright it appeared. That would tell you how hazy the air was, which was all well and good. The Achilles heel in that is that you couldn't calibrate that instrument. There was no way of shooting that light beam through 4 miles of gas that you knew exactly how much light it was absorbing so that you calibrate it.
Hmm.
And so we had a different instrument called a nephelometer, which was a chamber. And it was the same sort of deal where you had a light and it would shoot through a chamber that was about a foot tall. And the light detector, instead of being opposite the light, would be off to the side. And if you've ever been in a dark room and there's a crack in the curtains and you can see the dust sparkling
right
in that light beam.
Yeah.
And the nephelometer works kind of on the same principle, where if there's no particles in the air, the light beam would shoot through the chamber, and if you were looking at it from the side, you wouldn't see anything.
Okay.
But the more particles there were in the air, the more light would be refracted off those particles, and you pick it up by that side detector.
That makes sense.
And the advantage of the nephelometer is that you can close that chamber. You can fill it up with a gas that you know exactly how much light it's going to shoot off to the side. And you can calibrate it.
Okay.
So the advantage of it is that you can calibrate it. The disadvantage of it is that it's a point measurement.
You're just
measuring the air right there at the machine instead of over a path that's, a few miles long. And
I mean, that's kind of funny because I could look at my hand. I could see my hand just fine. But when I look up at, across the canyon, I'm like, oh, it's a really hazy day today.
Yeah. And that's where, we would co-locate the nephelometer with the particle samplers, and that would work really well because we'd have a point measurement for particles, we'd have a point measurement for visibility.
Oh, great.
But in terms of trying to recreate the visitor's experience of looking at the Grand Canyon, the transmissometer was better, but we couldn't calibrate it.
Right.
We would have numbers, but they weren't tied down to a known value.
Known standard or...
Yeah.
So it could tell you relatively for that instrument what was going on, but you couldn't compare it to any other instrument anywhere else.
Right.
Wow, and that's frustrating.
You could do comparisons, but there was always that nagging doubt.
Huh. Sure.
So that was.
It's funny you mentioned sort of the class one areas. When I think of Grand Canyon, I immediately think of the Navajo Generating Station at Page, Arizona, which is a coal-fired power plant.
Mm-hmm.
If I turn the other way and I look off to the southwest, I get up high enough and I look hard enough, I can see the Los Angeles Basin. If I look to the south closer, I can see Phoenix, a giant metropolitan center. And off to the west is Las Vegas, with one of the busiest airports on the planet. So it seems as though we would look at Grand Canyon as this really nice class one area, but in reality it's surrounded by some pretty major centers of pollution.
Right. And that was one of the driving things that was going on, was that we were, when a lot of these massive power plants were built, the Navajo in particular, back in the 60s and the early 70s, the saying was that the solution to pollution was dilution. You put these big power plants or copper smelters, to a lesser extent, you put them out in the middle of nowhere, and yeah, they would emit air pollutants, but by the time the air pollution got to anything that quote unquote mattered, it would be so dilute that it wouldn't cause a problem. And by the time I got to Grand Canyon, we were discovering that wasn't true. So when I got to Grand Canyon, they had just a couple of years before had a big study looking at the Navajo Generating Station, because what we found was that in the summertime, the prevailing wind was out of the south or the southwest or the west, and the plume from Navajo would blow away. And it would impact places like Mesa Verde, another Class 1 area,
right,
things like that. But it really didn't impact Grand Canyon all that much. In the wintertime, the airflow is out of the northwest, and generally speaking. And coming in from the northwest, it would arrive in these big cold fronts. And between the cold fronts, the air kind of stagnates until the next front blows through. And during those periods of stagnation, local pollution sources become much more important because the air's not going anywhere. And so in the case of the Navajo plant, what we thought was that the plume from Navajo was coming out of the stacks, sticking around, and sinking down into the Grand Canyon. And, you pick up pretty much any picture book of the Grand Canyon, and you can find these photographs of inversions in the canyon where the canyon is full of clouds, and just the north rim and the tops of some of the temples are poking up through this cloud layer.
Right.
And it's just gorgeous. But there were other times where you would come out and instead of clouds, there'd be this gray haze in the canyon, the smoggy layer down there. And not quite so pretty. We all laughed. The Grand Canyon Railroad had an ad in the magazines, and it was taken during one of these periods of it was, you know, a nice picture of the Grand Canyon, good shadows and all that kind of stuff. But it was taken during one of these dry inversions, and you get down about 1,000 feet below the rim, and suddenly everything turns gray in this photograph.
Wow.
And so in the late 80s, the Park Service had done a study. It was called WITEX, the Winter Haze Intensive Tracer Experiment. What they did was they released a tracer gas, an inert gas, from the stacks at the Navajo Generating Station. And then they had instruments that would detect that tracer gas scattered all over northern Arizona and southern Utah. And what they discovered was that, yes, indeed, the plume from the Navajo Generating Station was rising up out of the plant, sinking down into the canyon, and it was a major contributor to that haze in the Grand Canyon during those winter inversions.
Okay.
And so the Park Service had done their study, come out with these results. And then the plant operators, led by the Salt River Project, did their own study and came out with a different set of results. And it's kind of not a real surprise, but
right.
I don't know if I mentioned before, but you know, the Park Service has this responsibility to protect things from protect park resources from air pollutants, and has no authority to do anything about it.
Right.
We have to go to the management agency that does have regulatory authority over a source, convince them that there's a problem, and then go with it. And that, what is it, that whining that the Park Service does actually goes up to the Secretary of the Interior and the Assistant Secretary of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks administratively. So there were these two competing studies, and the Secretary of the Interior at the time, Manuel Lujan, decided that he wasn't going to decide. He said that rather than him trying to make a call between these two studies, he was going to turn it over to the National Academy of Sciences and have them make a call. So the National Academy of Sciences reviewed the two studies, and they called in the Park Service and said, okay, based on your studies, your attribution, your decision that 80% of the haze in the Grand Canyon in the wintertime is caused by the Navajo Generating Station isn't supported by this data. There's, you know, and then they listed off the problems with it. one of them was that at the time, there was no particle monitoring inside of the Grand Canyon. All the monitoring was being done for particles up on the rim.
Okay.
And so what the park did was they looked closely at the inversions, and when the inversions lifted, they could detect that pulse of extra particles as the inversion cleared the rim and that haze started spreading out. Then they could detect it up on the rim. And that was definitely a weak point in the Park Service analysis. So basically the National Academy said, you know, no, we can't support this attribution of I think it was 80%. So we did our own analysis of the data, and we decided that there's a wide range of possibilities, anywhere from 70% to 100%.
Huh.
It's going, okay, 100% sounds good to us.
Mm.
Then they looked at the plant operator study and really trashed it. There were all kinds of problems with that particular study. One of them was that the tracer gas that they released from the power plant was the same as one of the gases that they used for calibrating some of their instruments.
Oops.
Scattered all over the Southwest. So they were contaminating their own data set. Lots of different problems about that. And so the bickering continued. And that's right about when I started my job, was both studies had been completed. The bickering was going on. And then the EPA basically said, okay, plant operators, and there was a lawsuit brought by the Grand Canyon Trust and some other conservation groups, and they said, okay, we're going to, not quite literally, but almost literally, just lock you guys in a room and let you hash something out. And the Park Service was not included in those negotiations. The Grand Canyon Trust was. Roger Clark, who still works for the Grand Canyon Trust, I think was one of the lead negotiators in that. But they hammered out a compromise agreement where the Navajo Generating Station would start installing scrubbers to remove the sulfur dioxide from the from the plant gases, because the sulfur dioxide was the major contributor to the haze that we were seeing in the Grand Canyon. But the scrubbers would be delayed somewhat from what they could have been. They wouldn't have to start building them right away. They were given a few years of leeway. And the percentage removal was not quite what the... the best, what we would call best available control technology. They said, okay, it doesn't have to be controlled quite to that level. What that did was it allowed the plant operators to delay the installation for a little bit, and then they had three stacks at the Navajo Generating Station, and they would have to install a scrubber on every stack, but with the lower removal requirement, they wouldn't have to install a spare scrubber. What they could do is if one of the scrubbers broke down, they could make the existing scrubbers more efficient and make up the difference over the averaging time. So it's all very complicated and arcane, but that was kind of... that's the way those things work. So here I am. I've started the new job, and I'm puzzling through the YTEC study. I'm puzzling through the plant operator study. And right about the time that I finally figured out how all the pieces fit together, they announced the settlement, and George Butch came to the South Rim to watch the EPA administrator sign the order that would require the scrubbers on the Navajo Generating Station. So I was I was as much a bystander on that as anything. But
once the scrubbers were installed, did you see a change in the air quality?
We did. We did. You could look at the scrubbers were installed over a period of time, scrubber one, scrubber two, scrubber three, and looking at the winter data, you could see the step down in the sulfur dioxide or the sulfate. There's some chemistry that happens between the smokestacks and the canyon, but you could see a stepwise drop in those concentrations in the canyon. The flip side of it was that the right about the time that the scrubbers were being installed, the controlled the management fire, what we called prescribed fire in the park, was ramping up, and so there wasn't the tremendous improvement that we had hoped for, because as the power plant emissions came down, the smoke emissions went up. But even so, there was a gradual improvement in visibility in the canyon.
Right. That's another thing that I think I don't necessarily think about is smoke, particulate matter from fires, north mm-hmm. rim or off to the southeast.
That became a big issue later on.
Hmm. Okay.
So I was, like I say, I was as much a bystander on that as any. We get back to my role in particular. You know, I was already familiar with most of the instruments at Grand Canyon when I started my job, and the nice thing was they were all working, unlike petrified forest. The flip side of my job was that in the interim, between the temporary employee that had been doing the work and when I started on the job, my boss, Linda Mazu, had been covering most of the work. She'd been maintaining the monitoring network, and she'd broken her ankle skiing. And so things were kind of behind when I started on the job. And so by the time I started, Linda was getting in better shape. She could do a little walking again, and so we toured around all the sites. We had the cameras, a couple of cameras, up on top of the watchtower at Desert View, snapping off their picture a day. Then we had the Moran to Grandview transmissometer, and then at Yavapai Point and Phantom Ranch, the other transmissometer. There was a particle sampler at Hopi Fire Tower and that wet deposition monitor. And then out at the Abyss site, we had the ozone monitors and the dry deposition monitor. And so I was starting to maintain those guys. And because we were Grand Canyon, they watched a lot of our instruments were hooked up to modems, and they would download the data every night when it was available. And if something wasn't working right, I'd generally hear about it the next morning.
Right.
And I do remember I had just started work. I'd been on the job for maybe a week or two, and the contractor called me up. He says, "Carl, the RIN transmissometer quit reporting last night." And I said, "Okay, well, in a couple of days, I have to go out and change the film out of Desert View, so I'll pop in and see if I can take a look at it." And this was a guy that I dealt with the contractor when I was at Petrified Forest, too. He and I knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, "Carl, you're not at Petrified Forest anymore. This is the Grand Canyon. You need to go out there today and see what's wrong." And it's kind of, "Oh, okay." And so that was kind of a little attitude adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly didn't mind. I really enjoyed putzing around on the instruments. And as time went on, I got better and better at being able to fix things.
Nice.
I was I was allowed to fix things that most field operators weren't allowed to do.
Cool.
And the problem was that, you know, if we couldn't fix it in the field, then we would have to package up the entire instrument, you know, this darken electronics, and ship it to whoever to get it fixed, and then have them ship it. Well, lots of times what they would do is they would ship us a replacement instrument, and then we would go out, install it, and ship the return instrument, use the packaging to ship the faulty instrument back to them. So it was a case of, there were some rather delicate fixes that you could do to these instruments. And periodically I would find out what those were. And some of the guys in the contracting office were comfortable with me doing them, and other ones weren't. And so I would eventually get to the point where, okay, I think that, you know, the shutter on the lamp isn't working right, and I'm not even going to call them before I check it myself, even though that's something that we're generally not allowed to do. And, you know, some of the guys won't let me do that, but other guys will. So I'll do it and then let them know.
Okay.
And so that worked pretty well. We had
did occasionally they send out somebody to kind of, and you would kind of hang with them and watch what they were doing for some little extra training.
Yeah, they would. Well, there were a couple of things that they would do. One of them was we would be audited. All of the monitoring systems had audits that were done periodically on them. Some of them, like the wet deposition, for example, there was an audit where they would create a fake sample of acid rain, to use the popular term, a fake sample of acid rain in the labs back at the University of Illinois. Then we would go out and on a week that we had no precipitation during a specified time period, a week that we had no precipitation, we would dump, or no, it wasn't, yeah, we would take a clean collection bucket, we would dump the fake rain into the clean collection bucket, and then we would go through our normal procedures. And then we would send the results in, and they already knew what the results were supposed to be, and it was an audit front to back. You know, they would not only be auditing what I was doing out in the field, but then they would also be auditing the chemistry that they did in their labs when they got that sample in.
Wow. Huh.
And so they would do that. Other auditors would come out and with parallel instruments to make sure ours were working correctly, or, you know, sometimes it was as simple as taking a temperature probe and putting it in a jar full of ice water and making sure that it read 0 degrees centigrade, you know,
right,
things like that. Right. So we were audited periodically, and then also sometimes instruments would break down majorly, and it wasn't the sort of thing where I could send a faulty component in, and so somebody would have to come out and work on the instruments. And I would work with them.
Where were the companies located that had to come out to work on this stuff?
Let's see. The Air Resource Specialist was in Fort Collins, Colorado, and they were responsible for the transmissometers and the nephelometers and the cameras. The dry deposition, or the wet deposition, the acid rain, was run out of the University of Illinois. The particle samplers, called improve samplers, improve, one of the things in air quality is everything is an acronym. So improve particle samplers stood for interagency monitoring of protected visual environments.
Okay. <Yeah.
laughs> So the improve folks were at the University of California, Davis, basically, they had a research nuclear reactor that they could generate the croton streams that are needed for some of the analyses of the filters.
So you have Fort Collins, and you have California folks, Caltech.
University of Illinois for the acid rain.
Long ways away for people to travel.
Yeah, and they would, some of the networks were denser than others. I would see people from UC Davis. Oh, I'd see them at least once or twice a year.
Hmm.
I'd see folks from Air Resource Specialists up in Fort Collins. Probably about three or four times a year. The acid rain folks, every few years would come out to the site.
Hmm.
The ozone folks would come out, I think, twice a year to conduct audits. So it was a variable schedule, and as time went on, I got better and better at maintaining the equipment. So I know, one of my biggest faux pas, I guess you could say, was I had a data logger, which was, this would have been, probably in the mid to late 90s. And the data logger is kind of like a really stupid computer. It's a lot of it is hardwired. It takes the in the case of this data logger and most of them on a set schedule, and on this one it was every I think 3/4 of a second. It goes through and it asks every measurement instrument what its reading is.
Hmm.
So, what's the ozone concentration? What's the wind speed? What's the temperature? What's the rainfall? Goes through, collects all those data, and then starts averaging them into 1-minute averages, 5-minute averages, hour averages, daily averages, and then stores the data that we want. Usually it was hourly averages. So
okay.
So it's kind of the mastermind. It's the one that's actually taking all of those instruments and recording their information. And one of my data loggers on one of the ozone that was the EPA system wasn't working right. And so I was using my little voltmeter and going through and doing continuity checks inside, trying to find a broken circuit in there that would explain why it wasn't collecting the data. And as I was doing that, one of the probes on my voltmeter accidentally shorted out the power supply.
Oops.
And so there was this blinding flash of light and a ball of smoke about the size of a basketball that kind of rolled up out of the instrument up to the ceiling.
Oh, dear.
So I got on the phone and talked to the guys, and they said, oh, man, we don't have a spare that we can send you out right now. Do you think you can fix it? It's kind of like, well, I don't know. And so I said, I'll give it a try. And so I went back to the office and got out the manual for it, which is about, 3 inches thick, and started working my way through and found out that this particular type of data logger wasn't a production standard. That each one was manufactured specifically for this program, and they weren't always the same. And so consequently, I did fix it. They sent me a new power supply, and after about a week of 8 or 9 hour days out there at the abyss, I did get it back up and running again. But sometimes the repairs were a little bit more involved than others. And then there were also the transmitter down at Phantom Ranch could become kind of an issue as well. The Inner Canyon stuff that we had, the transmitter at Phantom Ranch and then the particle sampler at Indian Garden, we kind of relied on the rangers to take care of those.
Okay.
But some of the rangers were better than other rangers at maintaining stuff. And down at Phantom Ranch, if I had a problem with that instrument down there, I'd pick up the phone, I'd call them up, and I was always delighted when it was Shores. Shores, the volunteer down at Phantom, because he'd been there forever. And I could tell him, Shores, the timing's off on the transmissometer. And he knew exactly what that meant, and he knew exactly how to fix it.
Cool.
And, and that was all I needed to do. I get one of the other rangers, what you need to do is go up and you'll open up the box, and inside there's a telescope. Don't touch, don't mess around with the telescope. There's a little black box. Open up the black, blah, 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 blah.
Hmm.
So it was always a delight when Shores answered the phone because I knew it was going to be fixed.
Nice. Fun.
Then we have other rangers who were less less familiar with it, but eager to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we got to the point where I wound up just taking over some of the monitoring systems. For a while, we experimented with having the rangers at Desert View change the film on top of the watchtower, but they would get called away on an emergency or something like that, and not get back to changing the film out or whatever for a day or two.
Oops.
And that just wasn't good. We were losing too much data.
Yeah.
And down at Indian Garden, we were having trouble with getting the particle sampler changed out. And so consequently, eventually, I wound up being responsible for those. After a couple of years, I did have an assistant. And initially, they were volunteers. And eventually I got a position.
Wow, like a seasonal or?
Usually subject to furlough.
Okay.
I didn't want seasonals because, at that time pretty much any time, seasonals wouldn't be around long enough. By the time I finished training them on the instruments and they were getting good, their season was over.
Okay.
And so in the long run, it didn't save me any time. But if I got a subject to furlough person or something like that, not subject to furlough, but a term employee, they would stay around long enough that I would get the training time back again, so to speak. I could get them trained up, and then they could operate reasonably independently enough of the time that it recouped the time I'd spent training them.
Did you have a station set up out at Torreweep, which is way out in the western end of the park?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a brief study that we did. It was 2 years, maybe three. But yeah, we set up a station basically, and this would have been in the early 2000s.
Okay.
So we did a number of special studies. Grand Canyon had a very good record in terms of data, and so it made us a good place to do special studies where they could augment that continuous data that we were doing with special studies to zero in on a particular problem.
Okay.
The Torreweep station was, we were interested in seeing how much of our ozone was coming from Las Vegas.
Oh, interesting.
So what we did was we set up two high-tech continuous ozone samplers. One was at Meadview and one was at Tui. And then we had the one on the south rim that ran all the time. And then we also set up some passive ozone samplers. And the passive ones were little car cartridges full of a chemical that would react with ozone. And we would set those out for a week at a time, and then send the cartridges in for analysis, and it would give us the average ozone concentration over the course of the week.
Did you indeed see a higher concentration at Meadview, dropping off a bit at Torweep, and then dropping off yet more, you know, out of Desert View, something like that?
What we saw, similar to that, what we saw was at Meadview, the Las Vegas metropolitan area did their own ozone monitoring, so we didn't have to do anything there.
Okay.
Like most major urban areas, they had continuous ozone monitors set up.
Right, so you had access to their data there, so that's nice.
Mm-hmm. And what we found was that the sampler at Meadview tracked pretty closely the other Clark County samplers. It was lower, but it rose and fell in a similar pattern to what you saw from Las Vegas.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Then the sampler at Torreweed correlated with Las Vegas, but it depended on the wind direction. And, you know, you never set up one of these, you know, the ozone sampling, the instruments are expensive, and it's pretty time intensive to work the data once you've got it collected.
Okay.
So you always set up an ozone sampler like that with meteorological sensors.
Hmm.
And so what we found out was that at Torreweep, it would track Las Vegas with an upcanting wind, the ozone levels would go up when the wind was blowing up the canyon, and they would go down when the wind was blowing down the canyon.
Well, that makes perfect sense, given that Vegas is down canyon.
Yeah, so instead of tracking Las Vegas, it was tracking the wind.
Hmm, okay.
With an up canyon, and so it was, you know, it wasn't a slam dunk, but it was good data. It was showing, okay, there appears to be a connection here.
Right.
And then what we saw on the South Rim was essentially almost never a correlation between the two. By the time you got as far away as the South Rim monitoring stations, there were enough other factors, mixing the air between Vegas and the South Rim, that we couldn't correlate the ozone levels there with Vegas.
Right. But it's funny because when the wind would be out of the southwest and the ozone at Torreweep would go up, the air quality probably at the South Rim would get better because the smokestacks just north of the park up at Page would be blowing off to the northeast, and vice versa. When that wind pattern turned around, the park at the South Rim would be inverted and kind of gunky looking. At Torreweep, the ozone will go away because
sort of. The thing there, though, is that the Navajo generating station, the big coal-fired power plants, don't produce very much ozone.
Oh, right.
So our big ozone sources were the metropolitan areas.
Hmm.
But by the time you got to the South Rim, pretty much what you're saying is true if you substitute Phoenix.
Ah, okay.
And you'd have Phoenix, you'd have Vegas. On rare occasions, like Albuquerque or El Paso or Salt Lake City or something like that. But
right.
That was pretty flaky.
As you had a train of ozone monitors out heading toward Vegas, did you have any ozone monitors heading toward Phoenix? Were you able to tie into anybody else's data sets, say Williams I'm thinking of the Verde Valley or Prescott, something like that?
Yeah, no, we really didn't.
Hmm, okay.
And that was a project where we got interesting data over those couple of years, and it was, I'm trying to remember who the ranger was at Torreweep. don't remember now. But the first summer of the study, the two-week station, it looked like a little Mars lander or something sitting out there on this big tripod with an instrument box and a meteorological instrument mast sticking out of the top of it.
Huh.
And it was out at the old dump on the that's I think since been rehabilitated. But as you come into Tui, right at the ranger station, there was a two track that went west across Torwood Valley,
right.
And eventually wound up at the cove on the west side of the mouth of Torwood Valley.
Okay.
The dump though was right at the west side of the valley, just at the base of the rim, and the volcano's going up there. And the first summer that we had the instrument out there, it was all hooked up with a satellite phone, so we could download the data. And if something broke down, I could get in touch with the ranger out there, and they could go out and do what needed to be done to bring things back to life. Or somebody from, who was it? Air Resource Specialists. They were the ones that were doing that, the contractor.
Okay.
They would send somebody down to work on it.
Hmm.
Second summer, though, there was no ranger at Tui. And so we'd have these breakdowns, and I would do day trips from Sinop's Rim out to Tui. And, it was just pretty much take everything I could possibly need and go out there and try and fix the instruments. And they trained me up pretty well on them.
Cool.
They were different than the ones that we used in the main monitoring stations, and take everything I needed out there. And I think every time I was successful in either fixing the problem or at least identifying it so they could send me a replacement component. There was one time I went out, during that summer it was kind of interesting because the first time I had to go out to Tui on one of these day trips, I actually followed the Mojave County grader. So the road was just fabulous.
I bet.
Over the course of the summer, I watched it gradually deteriorate on my trips out there. And there was one where I went out and they just had some big monsoon storms, and the floor of the valley was flooded. And I had to park about a mile from the station and load up everything into my pack and then wade through ankle-deep water.
Oh, wow.
And across the floor of the valley over to the station, do the work, and then wade back again.
Wow.
Another time, I would always try and get an early start. I got out there, and the thunderstorms, I could see clouds in the valley building up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, okay, this doesn't look good, but there's really nothing really big building up. Well, once I got up by Hancock Knolls, where you climb out of Torwood Valley and start heading across the flats towards Fredonia, I could see that I had not been able to see the worst of it, but there were some really big thunderstorms out there. And, of course, I was in a government vehicle, so it wasn't my suspension and tires. And so I kind of rushed back to the pavement, and I had to stop at Pipe Spring for gas. And while I'm filling up with gas, I see this huge thunderstorm just dumping on the road.
Wow.
Down probably about 20 miles south. Okay, I think I got out of there just in time.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's 60 miles of dirt road that gets pretty impassable at times.
Yep, it does. So that was one special. We did some other special studies. We had a real big one. It was the, Measurement of Haze and Visual Impacts.
Hang on a second. Let me guess. So it's Measurement of Haze and Visual Impacts.
Or Visual Effects.
Visual Effects. All right.
Something like that. An acronym, it spells out the name Mojave. And it was a study of the Mojave power plant down in Laughlin.
Ah, Okay. And, hey, Carl, we've been going at this about an hour and 10 minutes. Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in here.
Okay.
And we will pick this up with the Mojave Power Plant.
Okay. We can do that.
Because that plant was shut down before the Navajo Generating Station. It would be good to know what you saw, what you set up, and then what happened.
Okay. Sounds good.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, let's go ahead and conclude part 12 of Oral History with Carl Bowman. Today is Friday, December 11th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much.
Sure. Thank you, Tom.